Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 502nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia. And Mike Allen, this week, is on assignment. But we have two really high-quality people to talk about a very, very tricky issue around COVID and vaccine for kids. We've had both of these people on the podcast before. We got Mike Colbert and Tony Nikinchuk. So welcome, guys.
Thanks, James. When you were talking about high quality people, I was wondering if you had somebody else fill in for us today.
Oh yeah, that's at the end of the podcast. Right. We're gonna dub those people in. But so, Mike, just let them know who you are.
Sure. So Mike Colbert, rural family physician, professor at the University of Alberta. I'm actually at the university today for like the first time in a long time, and it's dreary and snowy, but at least it's not floating away like lower the mainland BC.
Exactly. Yeah. And Tony.
Yeah, I'm Tony Nikinchuk. I am a drug utilization stewardship pharmacist with Alberta Health Services, and I'm based out of Peace River, Alberta.
And we're going to talk about a really easy topic to talk about. That's COVID vaccine for kids. And this comes out of a tools of practice that you guys did with a number of other people around the benefits and harms of the COVID-19 vaccine for children and adolescents. And you guys published this a couple months ago. And obviously, as with anything COVID, there's new data. So, Mike, I think you're going to go over what the tool said, and then we're going to talk about what else has come available in the last month or so.
No, perfect, James. You're right. So, Tony, myself, Jennifer Young, Alex Singer, and Paul Fritsch from your neck of the woods, James, actually put together this tool, I think just before Christmas, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And again, we wanted to look at, and this was kind of in our series of COVID vaccines, we've looked at adults, we've looked at real-world evidence, we've looked at adverse events, we have looked at vaccine hesitance, a whole bunch of things, because it's topical and it just doesn't seem to go away. And with the data coming out on kids, initially in press releases and then in publications, we thought it was really important for our listeners, readers, to actually know what the evidence is. As the readers probably know, this is how vaccines kind of progress. You start healthy people and adults, and then, you know, you kind of get extremes of ages. You start getting adolescents and kids, and then maybe some pregnant women, and we can talk about all of that stuff. But today we're going to talk about adolescents and kids first. And so just to define adolescents, I have teenagers, and sometimes they're adolescents, and sometimes I think they're children. But in the studies, adolescents were either 12 to 15, and as far as Pfizer went, and 12 to 17 in Moderna. And I'll go over the kind of key papers done that actually got them approved and got them kind of going down the road. It's important to know that in these initial studies that we are looking at patient-oriented outcomes, which includes COVID and not just antibodies and dose findings. So for these studies initially, most of the study participants were Caucasian. Most of them were American, although there was a multi-center study in here I'll tell you about. Most of them were relatively healthy. I mean, when you first start doing this, you don't look at although those that were probably have more comorbidities probably have the most to gain from it possibly. These initial studies had healthy young people, adolescents.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the way it should probably be done. That's the nuance of almost anything.
Right. Yep.
You know, there's no real reason to think that, you know, different necessarily age groups would respond that much differently. I mean, it is possible, but in general, you know, we as you said, we start with non-pregnant, older people usually, and then work our way down. And that's just that's the way it should work.
That's the way this kind of stuff should evolve. Yeah. And also our medications, when we get meds out, this is how they kind of go. So yeah, mostly Caucasian, mostly healthy, two doses. So we're going to give you a two dose efficacy. And remember, Pfizer was traditionally given 21 days apart. Moderna was 28 days apart. And then we'll talk about what NACI recommends afterwards. Mm-hmm. The follow-up was short, although these were large studies, the follow-up was relatively short in a couple months. And really important that this is not about asymptomatic cases. This is about cases that were symptomatic and laboratory confirmed COVID. So I think with that, we'll start with the adolescents. So the adolescents, we have, as everybody probably knows, we have two choices. We have Pfizer and we have Moderna. So the Pfizer study was 2,600 Americans randomized in a, well, 12 to 15 years of age, randomized 1-to-1 to get COVID vaccine or get a placebo vaccine. For this study, they looked at efficacy a greater than or equal 7 days post the second dose. And for COVID-19 cases, there were 18 cases in the placebo and 0 cases in the vaccine. So this is 100% relative risk reduction. Now, we know that real-world evidence that just got published, this got 2 days ago, that we know this is probably too good to be true, 0 and 18, and real-world evidence will shine some light on it. Severe COVID. So severe COVID was defined very similar to the adults. You had to have end organ failure, heart failure, respiratory failure requiring intubation, ICU admission, that kind of stuff. So for the Pfizer study, there was no severe COVID in either arms. And interesting in this, the patients were enrolled prior to Delta. So we had these initial COVIDs. Then we had Delta we thought was bad. Although when you look back, it's probably similar to what was before. Now we have Omicron, which seems to be more highly transmissible, but possibly less likely to end up in the ICU. So also COVID's evolving. This study was done prior to Delta.
Yeah. And so and when you look at the, sort of the absolute numbers, what we're talking about is about 1.5% of the people who got placebo ended up getting and having COVID and none in the other group.
Yes, I think you're right, yeah. James. Yeah, you bet. And this was a 1-to-1 arm. Yeah, so 2,600, 1,300, yeah.
When you have 18 in one group and 0 in another group, you don't even do statistics on that. It's just it's almost impossible that could be a chance finding.
Yes,
and that sort of stuff. And so, but the problem with only doing it in 2,600 people is we can't be sure that it's 100%. That's exactly what you're going to talk about.
Yeah, down the road, and we'll talk about the real world evidence, a case negative control study that came out of a much larger, and Tony will talk about that in a few minutes. I'll talk about Moderna now, and we'll get back. We'll go to the adverse events after we talk about Moderna for adolescents. So Moderna for adolescents was 12 to 17 years of age, so you can see just a little bit different for the age. This was 3,700 Americans randomized 2-to-1. So for every three people in the study, 2 got a vaccine, 1 got placebo. Their efficacy was evaluated at 14 days post-second dose. And similar, there was 0 in the vaccine arm and 4 COVID cases in the placebo arm. Again, small numbers. 100% relative risk reduction. We know this is unlikely to hold itself true in a longer study. Severe COVID was not reported by Moderna. And so we know that while these initial studies show 100% relative risk reduction and it works, it's unlikely to hold this true when you get a larger study.
Yeah. And so if you look at the absolute numbers, and again, this is, most of these are over, I think you said a 2-month period, Mike?
2 months. Yeah. Median of 2 months, James. Yeah.
So many of the adult trials were more sort of the 3 to 4 month range, I believe. And so they in theory would have more cases for two reasons, right? It was longer, but it was also in adults, which we think they're more likely to get COVID, I think, from based on some of the numbers that I think we've seen. So I think there's two important.
The studies were larger, James. Yeah, studies were larger in the adults as well.
Yeah. But the number of people who got it. So you know in the first study you mentioned it's the baseline. The placebo group is 1.5%, and in the Moderna one we're talking well under 0.5% of people. Like it's 4 out of 2,000 people. And so it's a pretty low number, which is it's good to see that it was 0 in the vaccine group, but it's important to realize that those are the absolute numbers that we're talking about.
Yep. And actually it was 2 Moderna for every 1 placebo. So maybe it was close to 4 in 1,000, not 4 in 2,000.
Yeah, 4. Okay. Yeah. So it's still 1 in 250.
100%.
Yeah,
you bet. You bet. And so, not surprisingly, the adverse events that they found, and these are solicited adverse events, and I think it's important that we have unsolicited adverse events. That's where patients, report afterwards, almost like a open spreadsheet, and they say, I had a problem, versus solicited, where they go through a laundry list of, did you have this, 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 and this. And solicited adverse events were, in the adult studies, were almost an order of magnitude greater than unsolicited, which is kind of what we see. It depends on how you ask the question. And we found very similar solicited adverse events in the adolescent trial. Localized pain, which would not be surprising, fatigue and headache in both of these. And it seemed to be about double what the placebo would be as far as fatigue and headache, but very similar. And again, very self-limited, short-term adverse events.
Yeah. And so the numbers are roughly like about 30% on placebo.
30% on placebo and about 60% with the vaccine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, for the fatigue and headache and for basically localized pain, almost everybody, like 90%
Yeah, yeah, 80 to 90%. And you're getting a needle in your arm, so I think it's going to hurt for a little bit of time.
Yeah. And I think it's a useful way to think about it is that just because, you know, and this applies to adults as well, just because you get the vaccine and then you feel fatigued or have a headache, if you use these numbers, it's still only, even if you did get it, there's at least a 50% chance that it's not because of that, you know, because the placebo group is responding in the same way, or not in the same way, but they have a 30% incidence of fatigue and headache. So it's always a nuanced thing. I don't think there's any doubt, Mike, that the vaccine increases the chance of fatigue and headache, and everyone sees that in people who get this vaccine. But it's at least good to know that we now have some evidence in at least the adolescent group. Now, it's not long-term data, right? We've got 2-month data. We don't know what happens beyond that from either benefit or harm perspective.
Correct. And Tony's going to talk about the real world evidence on adolescent vaccine in just a few minutes.
Cool. Okay.
If that's okay. Yeah. And then the children. So really important that currently we only have Pfizer mm-hmm. for children under kind of 11 and under. And the first study, the largest study published in New England again at the end of last year was about 2,200 children, 5 to 11 years old. This was multi-country, but also included American. An RCT, one-to-one again. Placebo vaccine versus COVID vaccine. Efficacy again, 7 days post-second dose. There were 3 cases with the vaccine and 16 cases in the placebo for a relative risk reduction, about 91%. There were no severe COVID for these kids in either arms. And again, this study and most cases of COVID occurred when Delta variant was a predominant strain. God, it sounds like Delta variant. It was like 6 years ago, and that was a few months ago.
I think it was around the turn of the century, if I remember correctly.
Amazing. Very similar adverse events. Again, localized pain in the arm, about 70%. Fatigue, about 40%. Placebo was about 28-30%. Some myalgias, 10 versus 7. So again, while it's more likely to have these adverse events with the vaccine, again, there was a very strong placebo response. Again, meaning the placebo vaccine, people had these very similar symptoms. There was no myocarditis or anaphylaxis in this study. And that will bring me to a second, just into myocarditis stuff. Just for the younger, so you get, okay, we got 5 to 11, Pfizer. We don't have, we don't quite have any data on, and Tony will talk about 2 to 5 on Pfizer and what Moderna's doing. Moderna, with the time of writing the tool, was enrolling 6 months to 11 years of age, and they did have a published paper, but it was only immunogenicity. Mm-hmm. And we really believe in patient-oriented outcomes, so we just kind of parked it and we're waiting for that, and Tony will get back to that. So we talked a bit about myocarditis, and we know that there's case reports of myocarditis, and so the initial data came out of Israel, and this is based on large core. As we know, Israel kind of went first, and as a result, going first with, they kind of had a deal with Pfizer, to get vaccines possibly at a discounted rate, but get it early. They had to report a lot of, had to allow a lot of the reporting. So coming out of Israel, they were finding that myocarditis was highest in the boys and in the age range of 16 to 19 years of age. The excess risk was in this study published again late last year, was about 14 per 100,000 doses. 75% of them occurred at a second dose, and the female to male ratio was about 1 in 10. So females had about 10% of risk of the males. The good news is most of these myocarditis are mild. And at the end of our conclusion of looking at the net benefit and net harm, even when we have some cases of myocarditis, strongly net benefit for COVID vaccine for our 12 to 17 years of age. And so that's kind of the data that we had kind of just around Christmas time. We had good data for both Moderna and Pfizer for the adolescents. We had some data for Pfizer for the children, and knowing that the studies will continue and likely have some publications coming down the road and some more insight on the risk of myocarditis and a few other things. So I'll probably turn it over to Tony. If Tony, does that make sense to you?
Just before you get, so I was going to ask Mike, so clearly none of these studies looked at, or none of these studies had serious cases of COVID, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So,
correct.
So the, so how were they getting the, you know, when you do a sort of a net benefit, how do you, how is the data being used to say that it would prevent this many hospitalizations and ICU admissions? Are they sort of extrapolating that information?
Yes. I think it was modeling data.
Yeah.
You bet. Based on, and they were trying to, basically they were trying to recognize that myocarditis seemed to be a rare adverse event associated with this vaccine. But when you actually look at the benefit of using COVID vaccine in adolescents and children, and then modeling down the road, the likelihood of, again, admissions, hospitals, all that kind of stuff, that there was a net benefit. So yeah, based on modeling data.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an important to sort of work through the numbers, because it's not, it's at least the way I, when I look at these numbers, it's not overwhelmingly a net benefit, it relatively speaking. I mean, it's, you know, they're saying that for every million doses that you use, you prevent 215 COVID-19 hospitalizations, which is a very small absolute number.
Correct.
You know, it's, you know, not an unimportant number, because, you know, you don't want any hospitalizations. So they're saying per million doses, 215 COVID-19 hospitalizations, 71 ICU admissions, and 2 deaths. But it is important that that is not based on the randomized controlled trials, because we don't have it sort of like you said, not an extrapolation, but a modeling process. And so we got 215 hospitalizations, 71 ICU admissions, and 2 deaths. The negative is the 65 cases of myocarditis. And again, that, even that is a sort of a modeling exam process. It's not based on the randomized controlled trial data.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just it's a context. So, and unfortunately, you know, when we only have studies of, you know, a few thousand people, it's hard. No study picks up these more rare side effects. And they also don't pick up if it prevents severe COVID, because almost no kids get severe COVID. And that's the nuance around it, right?
Yeah, you know, and further to that, maybe we should say at the time where these studies were actually being done and we were talking about this, the risk of hospitalization of if somebody got COVID in a child under age 19 was about 1 in 200. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it was a little against the law of large numbers, the majority or 80% of these admissions were in healthy children. And it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't overwhelmingly the with comorbidities that were being admitted to hospital. So I think that number is a little bit different now. And I think Tony's going to shine some light on kind of how things have progressed in the last month or so.
Yeah, no, that'd be great, because like I said, this changes every day pretty much.
I think it just changed again.
Yeah, I know. It changed since I made that comment.
It just changed since we started the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So go ahead, Tony. Yeah. So if you could just, and by the way, good work on this tools for practice. This is it's a very tricky area. And, you know, I don't think we're not saying one way, or the other, whether everybody should be vaccinated or not, but this is what we try to do, is give you the best available evidence.
Yeah, and you know, just a couple comments, I guess, too. I was just kind of frantically like researching stuff in the background as you guys were talking, and because I thought I had seen some follow up data from Pfizer. So there was something published, but it was a 6-month follow up of their initial adult trials. Mm-hmm. There is a little bit longer term data. They do have an announcement via press release, which we know is a terrible way to get medical evidence. Of follow-up data from their 12 to 15 year old trial, and just essentially, you know, pumping its tires further and saying that the adverse event profile was generally consistent with the other clinical safety data, and no serious safety concerns were observed with up to 6 months of safety follow-up after the second dose,
which is great.
None of that's been published yet.
No, but you need that information, and you know,
of course,
you know, you have to kind of hope that they're providing, you know, legitimate information, and if they're not, then we're all screwed.
Yeah, exactly.
That right. Follow up, were they giving clinical efficacy and not just adverse events?
Yeah, 100% effective against COVID-19.
And the number of cases in placebo, did we know in the follow up?
No, they're pretty low on the amount of information in press releases, unfortunately.
In fairness, it'll be a new, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It'll show up eventually in New England for sure. So.
Yeah, you bet.
Oh, it does actually say in here, 30 confirmed symptomatic cases in the trial, all of them in the placebo group.
Okay, so now we're at 30-0.
Yeah, from 18. Yeah, exactly. And then, and you know, that that risk-benefit analysis from the CDC, you know, it, it, that's based kind of on population-level risk exposure over time and all that stuff that they have from just epidemiologic monitoring data. So, yeah, it's not, like you said, it's not perfect because they're making a lot of assumptions based on...
But it's the best information that we can have.
Yeah, it's all we have, right?
It's really all we have. And I think that's why... You know, there is some caution around, you know, when do you decide that there's enough evidence? And I don't think there's a right answer to that. And I think, you know, you can make an argument that, you know, this is, we still don't have tons of information in children. So it's difficult. But Tony, you're going to say this, there is some more stuff that's come out just recently.
Yeah, there's some more stuff. So I will just kind of quickly touch on the other trials for younger kids and and other age groups. Moderna, up to now, in that paper, it only, or in the tool, had only had like the 12 plus. They have submitted now for the 6 to 11 year age group. It's been submitted to Health Canada for approval, but the data itself hasn't really been released, just positive top line results in a press release. And then they did say they suspect data will be available for the 2 to 5 age group for Moderna coming up in March, they're hoping. Pfizer, this was kind of interesting, announced by the media that they've kind of had an amendment to their trial for the 2 to 5 year olds. After the second dose, they didn't see the immune response that they had expected for that age group. And for whatever reason, they did see a response that they were okay with in the 6-month to 2-year age group. So for the 2 to 5, they're adding a third dose to the initial priming series, two months after the second dose. So it was kind of a somewhat back to the drawing board approach for the 2 to 5 year old trial.
And, it's very tricky because that's such a surrogate marker. I mean, I hope it's a reasonable marker of whether or not the vaccine is working, but and that's why I think it's so crucial that with the tools of practice that you guys did, that you looked at, you know, cases of COVID, which I think otherwise it's so tricky. I mean, I've tried to keep up with some of this, the immune response that people get, and I can't. It's hard to make heads or tails of it. It really is.
Well, and they've got 14 different ways of measuring
it. Exactly.
It's very tough to evaluate. Yes. And they did. They went quite low. Like for the 2 to 5 year, they went to the 3 micrograms. And in the 5 to 11 kids, it's 10 micrograms. So they really did go down quite a bit. So maybe they lowballed it a little too far. Who knows? So yeah, there was as Mike said, a paper just published yesterday, actually, in the New England Journal. It was a test negative case control study. And it was actually out of the CDC, and then they published it in New England Journal. It was 445 cases versus 777 controls in kids aged 12 to 18. And this was among this large monitoring group of hospitals within the United States in, I think, 36 states, something like that. And so they took cases admitted for COVID-19, so kind of severe cases, really, if you think about it, and compared them to this group of controls and looked at the vaccination difference between those two groups. And when everything was kind of come through the wash, it was calculated that it was 94% effective against hospitalization, 98% against ICU admission, and also 98% against receipt of life support. There were 7 deaths among the cases in control studied, and all of those were among the control group. And this was, just as a note, this was done during a period that the Delta variant was dominant.
And so it's not randomized control trial data, but it's still fairly impressive, relatively speaking. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, this versus zero, you know what I'm saying is it's not perfect data. It's not cause and effect. It's there's, you know, a number of confounders in there, but you know, that, unfortunately, we're in a world where we have to use evidence that's not necessarily taken out of an RCT. We have to look at this sort of cohort data to give us some idea of the overall effect. What we do know is that the, you know, the rates are still, you know, of getting COVID in that population are still relatively low. Although again, we're only looking at some of this stuff is only 2 month data. So it's, but it's certainly all encouraging that it's doing what we think a vaccine should do.
Yeah. And it's tough with vaccines, right? Because if you look at it on population level, the absolute risk differences are going to be pretty tiny, right?
Yeah.
Compared to a lot of stuff we look at when we already, you know, people who are already sick or high risk of being sick, right? So it is a little trickier with vaccines for sure. On myocarditis, Mike had talked about the data up to date in the paper. And then we do have new data from the CDC again in the 5 to 11 year old cohort. So far, I think like eight, well, when they published it anyways, this was just late December, I believe. There was like 8.9 million doses given so far, and they had identified 11 confirmed cases of myocarditis through the reporting networks. And not all of it was just through the VAERS, which is kind of a voluntary reporting. Some of it was through this other reporting network called VSafe. And so it worked out to about like 1.5 cases of myocarditis per million doses in this 5 to 11 year old age group. So quite a bit smaller than the 16 to 19. Again, understanding that this is it's surveillance data, different data sets, it's over different periods of time. At least encouraging that it's a relatively small number so far. And, you know, as Mike said, the reports of myocarditis in other age cohorts, relatively mild. Most people recover. In the CDC report, they said of the 11 confirmed reports, 7 had already recovered at time of publication and 4 were recovering at the time of reporting. So again, encouraging outcomes to see in, you know, a pretty scary age group to get something like that, right? 5 to 11 year olds, pretty vulnerable young kids. So encouraging data to see for sure. And then the other thing that came out recently was, a real-world evidence study from the CDC again. And this was on something that a lot of people have worried about as a sort of longer-term sequelae of COVID in kids, and that's the MISC, so multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. And that can be a fairly serious illness, in some cases requiring ICU admission and life support. And so they are kind of concerned about this in kids. Overall, it's a pretty rare occurrence. The CDC report said about 6,000 cases overall in the U.S., which when I looked at it, represented less than 0.1% of cases among kids under the age of 18. But still scary if it happens. And they looked at this study in 12 to 18-year-olds, and it was similar to the severe outcome study I mentioned earlier. It was a test negative case control design, and they calculated that the it was pretty much mRNA vaccines, 91% effective against MISC in kids 12 to 18 year olds. So again you're looking at extremely small absolute numbers, but still encouraging relative numbers for sure.
And the relative numbers are very, very similar to what we saw with the in the adult population.
Yep. Exactly.
Really similar, and that's not. I don't think that's surprising. I don't think there'd be a legitimate reason why it might not. The whole issue around this is what is the, the risk in the first place, to people who are otherwise healthy. And so maybe you guys want to give a sort of context to this. Like, where do you see this? What do you think, and where do you think this is going?
I guess for myself, the context I look at is one is kind of what's the population risk of outcomes in this age group. And I just pulled up Alberta right now, and certainly if you look at kids, they have it split off at 19 in Alberta for some weird reason. But kids 19 and under, it does really drop off. The hospitalization rate among, say, 19 and under is around 50 per 100,000 individuals, and that's from the beginning of COVID. So that would be roughly from March 2020 to now,
right?
50 kids per 100,000 admitted to hospital. ICUs even much, much lower than that. It's about 6 per 100,000. And that compares to, ICU admission rate in the 70, 79 year group of 205 per 100,000, versus 6 for kids, right? So it is a huge drop off. You do get another little spike when you go to the under one kids, mm-hmm. Which kind of makes sense. They're pretty vulnerable and not the greatest immune systems. And then, so you know, that, I guess that's kind of how I look at it. And sometimes when I break it down, I'll take these per 100,000 population numbers and divide them out over the time since COVID hit Alberta, and think, okay, you know, over a year, this is a risk of a kid this age getting hospitalized. And then I look at the data and say, okay, this is a risk of him getting myocarditis if he gets the vaccine. And I kind of, you know, put them head to head, understanding again that it's an imperfect comparison. But it does allow me to give a bit of a risk benefit assessment in my head.
Exactly. So what do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I think if you look at the numbers, and I think we have to remember that this was done before COVID was running rampant, and we have to remember that now there's 6,000 cases a day in Alberta, and we're not even the winner anymore. We used to be the winner, and we're not even the winner anymore. And so I would look at it, if you really look at the numbers, and using what Tony said, 50 per 100,000, if that really is the risk of being admitted for hospital under the age of 19, I would consider that as 5 per 10,000. Yeah. And if I got a vaccine, it'd be now 5 per 100,000. If just ballpark 90%
risk.
Yeah. And so that's how I would look at it. And so, well, I agree with Tony. While the absolute rate is low, I still think the numbers, and I think it just depends on how you feel. I think this evidence is fairly strong. I think the evidence has evolved, meaning you've got placebo-controlled RCTs, and now we're evolving into test-negative case controls, which is how it has to evolve.
Right.
I don't think it's ethical at this stage now to have placebo-controlled RCTs. And while you might be underwhelmed with the numbers, I would actually say, you know what, these numbers would probably move me to get, and it has moved me to get my kids done. And I look at both the individual benefit and then the benefit beyond my family and my cohort.
Totally. No.
And so it's always challenging. Where do you, how much do you draw and how much do you extrapolate from an individual benefit to the benefit to society? And before, when we were trying to extrapolate absolute numbers based on what we anticipated the likelihood of getting COVID per year was, and I think when we first wrote the adult one, we said, well, maybe at the high end, it might be 20% per year in unvaccinated. Mm-hmm. And now we know that's completely not right, because we think it's going to be much, much higher. So in the context, I agree with Tony. I think that we have evidence that we know that the COVID vaccine is safe, as far as we can tell, for children and adolescents. I think we do have this small risk of myocarditis. And again, Tony gave us some numbers in 12 to 15 about one in a million, you know. And then if you really take Israel as being the worst, that's about one in 10,000, and that's boys 16 to 19. Mm-hmm. I would still take those numbers. And I think the overwhelming evidence is fair. Well, you say it's associated in cohort studies. I think it's just exceptional that everything is very similar.
When you see a cohort and it shows similar, you know, if a cohort sort of putting this in again into context, there are some studies that have looked at nothing to do with vaccines, but cohort data does in a good percentage of the cases, yes. You know, probably 60-70% of the cases reflect what we would end up seeing with randomized controlled trials. So it's actually yes. quite useful type of information, but it is important, and I would take a little bit of umbrage with you saying that the vaccine is safe, because I never even know what safe means. I think sure. we just stick to the fact that about 30% of people who get it will get fatigue and a headache, and about 90% will get some localized pain. But I totally agree with you. We're not just making decisions on the basis of individuals when it comes to a condition that's infective. That's the tricky part. If this was a non-respiratory transmitted infection, all bets would be off in a different approach, I think, because the risk is at present, I feel like I said, things are changing over every day. And you know, with all the new variants, it may become much more frequent, and it already is. You know, it does change, but we need to know what the risk is, and we are fairly confident that it's a 90% effective vaccine, and I think that is actually more effective than almost any of the vaccines that we've ever had. So that's encouraging, but we do have to be very vigilant about the things, even the one in the one in 10,000 risk of mRNA, or in some cases, some people report it's you know, maybe one in 100,000 or whatever. We do have to be, we have to be mindworthy of that, if you will.
100, yeah, completely agree with everything, James. I love the, I mean, I like how things have evolved from an RCT to a cohort. When we get fooled in medicine is we have a cohort that suggests something. Mm-hmm. And we go, wow, this is great. And then you go and do the RCT and you go, there's nothing here.
Yeah.
And so this is, so I'm happier that it's gone this way than the other way.
Yeah. So at least as of today, that's the best available evidence we have. And you can imagine why it's a tricky thing to know what to do. I'm a big fan of providing people with the evidence and letting them help their make up their own mind. But it's multifactorial. It may be for the individual. It may be for society. It may be that you're doing it because, you know, you think it's just the right thing to do. It's very tricky. But anyway, anything else you guys want to add?
I'll just add that, you know, I think probably the biggest hesitancy I've seen among all of the age groups will certainly be the 5 to 11 group. And, you know, I've certainly got friends and colleagues who they're vaccinated, their spouse is vaccinated, their 12 to 19 year old kids are vaccinated to 11. They're really sitting on this decision quite a long time. And the data in Canada backs that up. You know, most of the age groups in Canada are over 85% first dose coverage, including the 12 to 19 age group, which is at 86%. The 5 to 11 age group, it's been quite a few weeks now that it's been available, and they're only sitting at 40% right now for first dose uptake. And the rate of uptake has certainly been quite a bit slower than we've seen in previous age groups, for sure. So, you know, like you said, it's a difficult decision for a lot of people. And so the more we can do to get the data out there and get the information out there to people who are trying to make this decision for themselves and their families, and translate it for them in a way that's easy for them to understand, put risk and benefit into perspective for them.
Yeah.
I think that will help a lot in helping them make the best decision.
Yeah, no, and I think that's exactly what this podcast is all about. Not just this one, but, you know, in general, is to help people make those decisions. So anything else you guys want to add? Awesome. I think this was great. This is a very difficult area, not only just from looking at the evidence, but also realizing that this is not a static issue at all. And that's the problem that we've had with COVID ever since it started, is that this is not a static thing. But no, you guys did a great job. And why don't we just leave it at that? So thanks as always for listening.
So long for now.
See you later.